So welcome to all of you, and let's begin with a few words of specious invocation to bless our gathering today, to gain some presence, to land as much as we can to the here and now, so we can be as fully available for each other. And we can invite Sumoki to bless the gathering with a few words. Why not? With such a beautiful background, it's you must. It's not only because of the background, because of who as well, who you are as well.
Hare Krishna, everybody. I just hope that coming together today, we can open our hearts and grow together more, an understanding of our reality in this world.
Thank you. So welcome each one of you to our weekly satsang or encounters with the truth. Ishtagosti, journeying together, quest and exploration. I see it feels better for you today, naming today's gathering, if we need to name it at all, right? It's showing up, hopefully, as Brené Brown will say, right? Vulnerably, showing up when we do not have a control over the outcome. Not having full certainty about what will happen, how it will happen, what will happen to us in the midst of all that, but still daring to show up. Very healthy sign of participation in reality. So this is just a rehearsal of the macrocosm of our whole life, how we choose to show up, how we choose to relate, how we choose to participate, be part of something that we already belong to, but still it invites for individual choice, individual voluntary participation. So thanks so much for choosing to participate today. And as usual, if you have anything you would like to share today, an inquiry, doubt, some topic you would like to explore deeply, something you would like to bring to the table and share, you can raise your digital hand. And if for whatever reason you cannot do that, you can send a message in a written way. I've received a question sent a few days ago from Pranada that we'll be addressing in a few minutes, but also giving some priority to those who are connected live online. So I'm seeing so far the only raised digital hand is from Tribhikam Prabhu from New Zealand. So we'll invite him to unmute himself. Welcome. And you have a very interesting light on top of your head, which makes your face absolutely indistinguishable. But at least we have a circle of light around above your head. So there's some halo accompanying you. So no problem.
Maybe I can move. It's just on dusk here, on dawn. So
it's fine.
There's not
it's
a
fine.
Lot of light floating around. Anyway, as long as you can hear my voice, I suppose that's the key thing.
We can, yeah.
Yeah, good. Okay, so my question or my inquiry is relating to how we've been, especially within our upbringing and spiritual life, within Mahaprabhu's mission, has been very much, especially within ISKCON, the emphasis has been very much centered around outreach and around various types of outreach, but one in particular that interests me is Nam Sankirtan, where devotees are encouraged to participate in public, not say demonstrations, but publicly going out and chanting for the benefit of all living beings they may encounter. So I'm just wondering, within our kind of outlook here within the Tathagata Sangha and the emphasis that we might place on that as a practice, or whether with by inference and of the emphasis that it might be perceived here, that there's perhaps a different take on what we understand to be Mahaprabhu's mandate for spreading his name in every town and village. As for some of us, it's kind of an uncomfortable reality to go out there publicly. It's quite a vulnerable thing. And also, it can be quite a contrived thing in some regards, quite an artificial thing. It's quite, especially probably in the early days, it must have been quite an exotic thing for people to encounter on the street. There's all sorts of tales of people crossing the road to avoid the Sankirtan party and avoid an embarrassing moment. So I'm just wondering what is the take on that? How have we outgrown that? Is there a different is there a different kind of way that we could actually see that? Obviously, the idea of the Srivatsangan thing, where we actually have more of an inner cultivation of the radical mood that should underscore such a thing as there. But in terms of actually publicly going out and doing Sankirtan, what do we think about that?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Important question. Every question is important as long as it comes from an important place, if it's important for you. And I know it's important. So where to begin? Maybe we should begin by defining what Sankirtan, right? Because sometimes those things are taken for granted, right? And we define words with only one possible expression, while it excludes other expressions of the same thing, and then it becomes a problem. And many times it ends up being something that was very much unrelated from its original intention, you know, of the term, in this case Sankirtan. I know that some people sometimes at some point Sankirtan was basically for many collecting money. And no matter what you sell, and no matter if you lie to people while you are selling and you are telling people, no, this is a campaign for hungry kids in Africa, and actually that was not the case, but it's all Sankirtan. And you justify like, no, well, they give the money goes to the temple, and they unconsciously purify themselves. And for me, that there's a lot of stuff in between all that type of thinking, I will say, to begin with. So we are talking what Sankirtan is not first. And maybe it comes from this place of superiority complex, right? Like, I'm doing the highest thing, so no matter if I lie and I cheat everyone, I'm doing them a favor, even if they know it or not, which is like a little dangerous, because what's the line there, right? If everything can be justified in the sense of I'm engaging the whole world somehow or other in connection to Mahaprabhu's movement, even by taking away their money, mismatching their change and taking more money, or lying to them about what I'm actually doing. I mean, am I on that highest platforms that even I can do some such a thing with, at the same time, absolute integrity and universal compassion without compromising my ideals? I'm not so sure. So, and Sankirtan sometimes is connected to book distribution. I'm not against that idea, but I wouldn't say that's the only way to think about Sankirtan. And at the same time, Yeah, that's another conversation. The question today is not so much about book distribution unto itself, but how much that's a relevant practice for everyone, for some, how to do it, if to do it. That's another conversation. And it all depends very much time, place, and circumstance. I'm not here to give you any absolutes, right? You stop doing this, you continue doing this always in the same way. It's so sensitive. Like, even speak about chanting. There are cases during Prabhupada's lifetime that some devotees told him, "Oh, Prabhupada, we are going to sing in the streets in this place." I don't recall which place it was. And people is not favorable. It's getting a little even dangerous. And he says, "Stop doing it." Like, common sense. It's not that we are trying to have something against Sankirtan by saying that. It's just you have to take the pulse of the particular situation you're in. But again, go into an understanding of Sankirtan. Because Sankirtan not only means congregational chanting of the names of Krishna, let's put it that way, or publicly in the street chanting the Maha Mantra or other mantras. There are other forms of Sankirtan, there are other forms of Kirtan. For example, we always make difference between Kirtan and Sankirtan, right? Sometimes Kirtan, you could make some Kirtan by yourself, and Sankirtan is a collective phenomenon. We need each other. Fine. But also we can connect Kirtan with Harikatha, with speaking about topics like the ones we are talking now. For example, there are these nine processes of bhakti, Navalakshan Bhakti, Shravan Kirtan, Vishnu Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Bandhanam, Dasyan Sakhyam, Atmanivedanam, mentioned by Prahlad Maharaj in the Bhagavatam. And Rupa Goswami mentions different acharyas for each one of these processes, or different examples of people who attain perfection through specific absolute focus in only one of these practices, mostly. Maybe not only this, but mostly. And the acharya of Kirtan, interestingly enough, is Sukadev Goswami. And which was Sukadev Goswami's Kirtan? He was speaking the Bhagavatam. He was not playing kartals, mridanga, harmonium. He was speaking the Bhagavatam. That's Kirtan. And when more than one person is engaged in Kirtan, like for example, Ishtagosti, what we are doing now, like discussing together, there's a question, an answer, feedback, an input. It's not just one person speaking, it's a back and forth. We call that Ishtagosti. So it's not, if you're speaking by yourself, you could call that Kirtan. If you are speaking with others, how do you call that? Sankirtan. So what we are doing now is Sankirtan. Maybe there's no kartals and mridanga in Zoom. It will make a cacophony. It's a little bit complicated to activate all our microphones. But this is Sankirtan, technically speaking, by definition. So I'm just trying to broaden the horizons of how we understand the word. Because sometimes it's just Sankirtan is singing with instruments with other people. And for some, it's not even singing with other people for the sake of, for the love of God, but going out to the streets to get people. So again, you can see different layers of an understanding of the idea. But Sankirtan could be just two people, three people sharing heart to heart, sharing their own hearts, like Krishna describes the ninth verse of the 10th chapter of the Gita, Matchitamat Gataprana, Bodhayanta Parasparam, Katayantaschamam Nityam, Tushyanticharam Anticha. Getting together, nourishing one another, enlightening one another. There is a mutuality by speaking about me. Satatam kirtayantamam, Krishna said. My devotees always engage in kirtan. This doesn't mean that they are necessarily always praying mridanga or singing, literally, but they are always passionately absorbed in discussing all the topics revolving around love and truth. All that is Krishna. Krishna is love and truth and harmony and beauty. So Krishna Kirtan, to do Krishna Kirtan or Krishna Sankirtan, Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtanam, it's also talking about these things. No? In fact, that's many times how it happened organically among Mahaprabhu and his associates, who are Sankirtanai Kapitaro, right? Gaurani Tenanda are described like Sankirtana Kapita, the fathers of Sankirtan, the parents, the fathers of Sankirtan. There will be sitting Mahaprabhu and his associates sharing Harikatha Istagosti, like we are doing now, and talking. I'm becoming so deeply engrossed in the topic of a conversation and relishing and celebrating what's coming that at one point they need to wake to stand up and start to dance and sing. It's just taking naturally. It's not like, okay, guys, now let's stop the conference and pick kartals and start to sing. There was no like official start of it. It's just like an irresistible flow. And then at one point on the peak of Sankirtan, probably, or they just sat again and continued to talk with one another, sharing the insight that they had from the recent singing and dancing. And then they go again, wake up and start stand up and start to celebrate. So that's how it's ideally supposed to happen, no? From the Gaur Lila template, the original Sankirtan by Mahaprabhu and his eternal playmates. It's not so much something like we need to get people into our movement, let's capture them. It's more like, first of all, an inner expression of love. Sankirtan is expression of love. We sing for the love of God. And then that starts to overflow, as we always use the word, these two words, achar and prachar. Which sometimes prachar is inaccurately translated as preaching. And preaching is further inaccurately conceived as just converting people and convincing them by force almost. But prachar just means a prachar, a very special pra type of achar. Achar means behavior, personal experience. So achar, you're first of all have your own experience, right? Before speaking of outreach, as I like to speak in radical personalism, for outreach, speak about inreach. No? Which is your level of inreach? How much this whole thing is reaching inside of us? Before speaking of converting the universe, other people, how much converted we are? How much convinced we are about what we are doing, how much we have actual shraddha, not belief, but deep, undeniable faith. There are degrees of all this. So sometimes trying to convince other people, as I say many times, is not so much a symptom of strong faith, but it may be, in some cases, it may be a symptom of weak faith. I need to convince all of you. So in turn, you convince me back because I'm not so convinced myself yet of what I'm doing. So I need to see the whole world doing it. So then I feel a little bit more of reassurance. Okay, I must be in the right place because everyone is doing that. But that shouldn't be the motivation to share with others. I'm not against sharing, just in case to make it clear. I may not use the word preaching that much because unfortunately I will say historically the word has been too loaded with many things that do not have to do with the essence of prachar. So I will say first one has to, we were talking the other day, I think I referred to this last week in the podcast we had with Bhakti Lalita Devi, and when Srila Samarsh will reply, okay, give me a service, and he will immediately say first become acquainted with reality before go out and convert the world. First, become acquainted with the thing you want to talk about with the world. Become acquainted with reality. There are so many levels of that, and you can only share as much as you are acquainted, as much as you are not only convinced again, but naturally attracted. It has to be irresistible for you and for the ones who get in touch with you. So for me, it's more about becoming so acquainted, having so much inreach to some degree that that thing starts to overflow in you and that starts to sprinkle other people naturally, just by the way you conduct yourself. Remember, Mahaprabhu, the main, in one sense, the greatest conversion of Mahaprabhu the most powerful preaching convert he got into his movement, if you want to put it that way, was Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who was the greatest pandit of the world by that time, as it is considered. And Mahaprabhu converted him without speaking. In one sense, without even wanting to convert him. He just arrived to Jagannath Puri, Mahaprabhu. Again, this is a very nice example of speaking about achar and prachar. Now, what happened? Mahaprabhu is moving to Puri, right? Puri becomes Mahaprabhu's headquarters as a sannyasi. So when he's arriving to Puri, he sees the flag of the temple of Jagannath. He's not even seen Jagannath yet. He's seen the flag. That's enough Udipan. That's enough, like, trigger for him to enter in ecstasy and to run like mad, like a madman, to have darshan of Jagannath. And he sees Jagannath at the distance, and he runs to embrace Jagannath. So he has so much ecstasy that he cannot contain himself in just running and embracing the deity, which generally you don't see people doing that in a temple. That will be too crazy. Now, you may have guards and put them to jail. But if you have genuine love, you may not be able to resist. So he has so much ecstasy, he couldn't resist. But on top of that, he has so much ecstasy that he fainted on the way to Jagannath. So he had so much ecstasy, he ran to embrace Jagannath. But on top of that, he has so much ecstasy that he fainted before he could embrace Jagannath. That's how he arrived to Jagannath Puri. That's achar, my friends. No, there's a lot happening inside of Mahaprabhu's world. So Mahaprabhu faints. All these pujaris of Jagannath Temple are like, who is this figure? Recently arrived, volcanic, ecstatic personality. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya comes into the picture and he takes Mahaprabhu to his house to take rest, for him to recover. That's how the whole thing starts. It's not like Mahaprabhu was calculating anything. He just, out of achar, out of inner fullness, he ended up at Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's house. And then they've developed some relationship and friendship. And Mahaprabhu actually likes Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. He treated him as an elder. And at one point, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya wanted to share with him, with like fatherly concern, "You're a young sannyasi. I would like to school you in Vedanta so your vows remain fixed," with an affectionate heart. And Mahaprabhu said, "Yes. I appreciate your concern." So they sat to have a loving conversation. And then Mahaprabhu listened for a whole week in silence. And after that, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was converted. So Mahaprabhu's biggest conversion was not intentional first and was done in silence. He didn't say a word, basically. So it was his achar, the quality of his presence, that touched the heart of the greatest pandit on earth. So all this to say, going back to the question, of course, it's not so much let's go to the street and try to convince people against their will, and let's do this public singing that it's actually against my own will. I don't like it. I'm feeling comfort. In some cases, I'm not saying everyone. So if you are doing something that, first of all, you don't feel good, you feel uncomfortable, in some cases you may not feel fully sure if it's working, how do you expect to create an irresistible attraction from the environment if that's not happening in you to begin with? So again, I'm not against celebrating and singing and dancing in the streets. People need to see people in life, in words, singing and dancing more. You know, they are only accustomed to listening to the birds singing organically. But if they see a person singing and dancing in the street, they may think, "Oh, this guy's crazy." So I think it's a healthy pattern to normalize. We can sing and dance as part of just me walking on life, but it should be done in a way that really conveys that intention. And sometimes it may be a little bit too much. And I'm not speaking to any particular case or group or institution. I'm just saying, in some cases, that can be a little bit too performative and too much organized and too much like crafted in a way of trying to impress and create this certain image, which it should come from a very natural place, irresistible, uncontainable. Haituki apratihata. That's how the Bhagavatam describes bhakti, right? Savaipum sampado dharmo तो भक्ति रदोक्ष है हाई तो की प्रतिहता भक्ति हैज नो कॉस्ट एंड इट्स अनकंटेनेबल इट्स अनस्टॉपेबल सो एंड अगेन देर डिफरेंट वेज एस आई एम टॉकिंग आई वी गैन टॉकिंग अबाउट शेयरिंग हरिकथा दैट्स हाउ फॉर महाप्रभु स्टार्ट दे आर शेयरिंग टॉकिंग विद अदर पीपल एंड देन दे एंड अप सिंगिंग एंड डांसिंग बट इट ऑल बिगन विद अ हार्ट टू हार्ट सीटिंग एंड शेयरिंग सो मेनी टाइम्स बिफोर गोइंग टू द स्ट्रीट्स एंड ट्राइंग टू Impress people, maybe I can approach them on a personal level and get to know each other as friends and we may end up singing and dancing and celebrating life together. That's one option. Again, I'm not here to give any final Tathagata Sangha official stance regarding Sankirtan, right? We do it like this in our tribe, no? Because there's no one way to do things correctly. Of course, there are many ways of doing things correctly. There are many ways of doing things incorrectly as well. So for me, the main thing is understanding the right spirit, having a proper conception of what Sankirtan, and then that will take the necessary shape it needs to take in any given time, place, and circumstance according to every person's personal inspiration. Some person may feel inspired to write, to sing in the street, to talk to people, to concentrate on their practice, trusting that everything will follow. And there will be, I will agree, there will be that sequence. First, try to have something for yourself, some personal experience, and then only then you can think about sharing. And again, the sharing should come from a place of genuine compassion and celebration, not trying to convert, convince others, to convince yourself, not because you are supposed to do that, you are forced to do that, because if not, you do not belong in the group, you will be kicked out. Those are not the right reasons to share it. That's not how Mahaprabhu shared it again. I just gave you a few examples of how Mahaprabhu shared it. No, it all began with, as I always like to say, right? We are speaking about Mahaprabhu's movement. How did Mahaprabhu's movement begin? Well, with Mahaprabhu's heart being deeply moved internally. That's the original movement in the heart. Something that is moving me. So that takes me to movement. Mahaprabhu was so moved inside that he started to move outside to celebrate, to sing, to dance. Then other people saw his movement externally out of an internal movement, and they were moved internally, and then they started to move externally. And in that way, it became naturally epidemic, contagious. But it all has been first internally and then externally as an anubhav, no? As a symptom that follows bhav. Now, if you study these anubhavs or ecstatic symptoms that are like symptoms of ecstasy or love, one of them is dancing or singing. So that's a very interesting point. And by this, I'm not saying you have to wait to reach Bhava Bhakti to dare to dance and sing. But the point is, dancing and singing should come as an anubhav. Bhav means emotion. Anu means which follows in the wake of. So dancing and singing should follow in the wake of something that is moving you inside. If not, you are performing. And that's not, for me, a good representation of Mahaprabhu's movement. They were not performers. Again, that was epidemic. That was, again, how much can we imitate that? Probably we cannot imitate that. First, we may need to become acquainted with reality and have some actual felt deep emotion in our heart before thinking, let's take over the whole planet. And again, who say that we need to take over the whole planet? Why do I need that if I think that should happen? Why? No. Do I want to reduce the whole population on Earth to everyone being a Gaudiya Vaishnava? There are no more other mystical expressions on Earth. That's not the teaching. That's not the teaching. And we have this nama aparad, right? Those things that get in the way of the name, get in the way of a loving approach to the name. And one of those, the ninth one, is to preach, sometimes it's translated to preach to those who have no faith. In other words, the idea is to try And all that is said in the context of the name, of chanting the name. So trying to speak about the glories of the name, trying to convey the experience of the name to someone who is not open to that, or who has, it's not because it's a bad person. Again, we don't need to say, oh, they are, because they are demons or they are non-devotees, and that's why they have no faith and blah, blah, blah. They just first need to have a certain set of experiences in order to open themselves to the name, like probably we need it as well. So it just that, and it, that's an offense to the name. So that's an important point. If you want to chant the name properly, don't try to impose this practice, whether it is in the form of chanting, in the form of Harikatha. Don't try to make it forceful onto anyone. That's betraying the very purpose of the name, of the chanting, of the embrace of the yoga, that you are betraying your purpose. Each of these apparatus is basically a betrayal of what we are doing. So one of those is insist or trying to impose something without first allowing the person to have whatever experience they need to have to naturally accept things. And that could be done to others, but now it's coming to me. That ninth offense could be also done to ourselves. We can like force ourselves to relate to the name or to the practice or to singing publicly or to whatever in a way that is not proportionate to our current realization, to give an example. So I need to be this enthusiastic, I need to have this face, it should be, but still I'm not there. I need to first be moved internally. And then naturally everything else will follow, right? So that's another way of conceiving the ninth offense. And as I say to begin with, again, trying to make full circle, Sankirtan can take many forms. What we are doing now is Sankirtan. And some people will feel more safe in this type of sharing. Maybe this type of sharing may take them to explode into another form of Sankirtan, and they will go onto the streets and roll on the ground like madmen, and they will end up in jail. But that's another story. But my point is, yeah, there are different ways to engage in the Yuga Dharma also. Let's not be sectarian or narrow-minded. And again, Sukadeva Goswami spoke Bhagavata and he didn't play kartals, as I like to say. They actually needed to bring kartals and mridanga to awaken Sukadeva Goswami from the ecstasy he entered by speaking the Bhagavatam. So Sankirtan was used. It's interesting. He's engaged in Sankirtan by speaking, sharing Ishtagosti with Parikshit Maharaj, because it's back and forth. Parikshit Maharaj is sharing input. So this is an Ishtagosti, it's kirtan, mutual kirtan and Sankirtan. And that type of Sankirtan makes Sukadev pass out. So to bring him back, they bring kartals and mridanga. So another form of Sankirtan is brought, so he can resume his Sankirtan in the form of speaking the Bhagavatam. So it's all Sankirtan in the service of Sankirtan. Right? It's not like one competing against the other. Oh, the mridanga and the kartals, the service of the Bhagavatam, it's all one. It's all that is Sankirtan. Kirtan means kirti. Kirtan comes from kirti, fame. And fame in this case makes has to do with the practice that makes us more and more aware of the fame, in the good sense of the term, of the glories, of the qualities, of the beauty, of the object of our conversation, of our singing. It's all for the purpose of spreading those charming attributes, starting in us again, enrich, inner distribution, and then the rest becomes natural. Like the saying, so especially in Buddhist circle, they say this, but it can be applied anywhere. They say that when the lotus is blooming, you don't need to call the bumblebee. In other words, if a heart is blooming with love and realization, those who are ready for that, they will be naturally attracted somehow or other. You don't need even to call them. What to speak of forcing them, converting them. by force, the fragrance will spread, that the quality will become too attractive, irresistible. So, and again, with any of this that I'm thinking, saying, I'm not pointing even to Ishkan, to any particular group, because in every group you may find different ways of addressing the Sankirtan or anything. So it's not just this group, this mission, this affiliation, these people. It's, I don't know if that helps to be comfortable.
Yes, thanks, Maharaj. That totally resonates with me and aligns with my realization also. One thing I was thinking while you're speaking, there's many things we could reflect, but one is like you're saying that we don't need to necessarily be on that topmost level of bhava before we can start to dance and chant. In a sense, it feels to me like it's like the sangha. There's a certain vulnerability to show up, and that vulnerability is kind of synonymous with empowerment also. So to sidestep the activity of interacting with others in the name of not ready yet can be a bit of a mistake in a sense, but to actually realize there's an opportunity to come forward and to connect with the Lord somehow or other by being a little vulnerable, because it's not easy. The mind's always thinking, shall I ask a question or not? All these dynamics. But if you took that the mind's course, you'd never go anywhere. So that was just one reflection on that I had. But
Thank
yeah,
you.
I totally resonate, and it was beautiful what you said, and I really value what you're presenting, because that type of literalism of copy paste, Mahaprabhu's modus operandi in a sense, that's kind of, it's all too easy to turn into a fundamentalist kind of crusade, where Agyata Sukriti is the catchphrase, and we just go around as if we're God's gift to humanity. So it's like it's not good for anyone, and it doesn't evolve into a sense of really finding where one's heart sits within that activity. So yeah, that inner cultivation I think is so important.
And again, at the end of the day, even if we want to think of Sankirtan as chanting the names, it's all to be done for the love of God first and foremost. It's not like a marketing tool or something, like a bait to get people. That if that happens as a byproduct, let it be so. But as long as we are mainly focused in doing that as part of our own practice, naturally. Not only even like I'm singing because I want to be purified. Okay, that can be a level, but at the end of the days, I'm singing, chanting for the pleasure, to give pleasure to Radha and Krishna, to Mahaprabhu. Right? It's not even just like to ask for things, to get rid of an artist, what to speak of, to impress other people and get them in my group. But it's like an irresistible, natural celebration, celebratory movement. But again, it has to happen first of all. I have to have enough reasons inside of me to be convinced that that's the case, right? There is a case to celebrate, and there is a case to sing and dance, and I'm totally convinced. If not, we may need to gather those reasons so we can end up singing and dancing for the right reasons. Sometimes we need to stop singing and dancing so we can properly acquainted with reality, going back to Śrīla Siddhārāja, enough. So when you can become enough acquainted, you cannot but celebrate. No? That's how, again, that's how the movement started. They were so acquainted with reality, the nature of reality. Again, this is not acquainted with reality information and theoretical stuff. getting an exposure to how reality actually is. It's so irresistibly charming and beautiful that you cannot but celebrate that fact in song and dance and poetry and praise and the way you live your life, right? Because at the end of the day, and that's the last thing, because this is a long topic, and we talked about that in the past. And I remember we talked about that through Vikram Prabhu when we also did this series of lectures on the third verse of Shikshastakam in New Zealand, because that's the most important instruction given by Mahaprabhu on how to approach Sankirtan. But that verse is speaking about different attributes to cultivate and express, mostly in our relationships with other people. Not so much during the moment that you're officially playing harmonium or chanting japa, also, but now humility, tolerance, respect, all these type of qualities, they are all expected to be shown on a daily basis in your lifestyle. So that's Sankirtan in the broadest possible sense. It's not just when I'm singing, when I'm speaking the Bhagavatam, when I'm giving the class, when I'm chanting my japa. Hopefully that's Sankirtan. Hopefully. I don't know. But when you put your mridanga down, your japa beat down, close the Bhagavatam, it's not that Sankirtan stops. It just takes another form. Kirtaniya Sada Hari, Mahaprabhu says. Sada means always. Satatam Kirtayanto Mam. My devotees always do Sankirtan. I mean, you cannot always do Sankirtan non-stop, singing 24/7 forever. You go crazy. You go dysfunctional. You need to do other things, right? You may need to work. You have babies. You need to talk to your neighbors, cook, clean the bathroom. How all that can be Sankirtan also? So that's why I started. We have to have a broader enough conception of Sankirtan, because if we start with the wrong conception, a wrong sambandha to Sankirtan, and Sankirtan means Kirtan with sambandha, Sankirtan. If you don't have sambandha in your Sankirtan, you don't have Sankirtan. I don't know, what do you have? Something else, whatever. So proper Sankirtan is Kirtan not only in Sangha, but Kirtan is with sambandha, that's Sankirtan. Proper orientation, so we understand my whole lifestyle is our Sankirtan. How I relate, how I do anything and everything. From this third verse of Shikshastakam, which is the golden rule of the Golden Lord, right? So I think we need to play out the implications of each one of these words so we get the broadest, most spacious, most accommodating possible definition. So we do not end up with an utterly reductionistic trans definition of a word that can only mean one thing. And whomever doesn't fit into that one thing, oh, sorry, guys, you are out. You do not belong. You are not doing it. You are failing miserably. You are not being part of Mahaprabhu's movement. You are not in the Yuga Dharma. I'll pray for you for your next lifetime. No. We just need to. No, to broaden, to broaden, to broaden, to broaden. Not to broaden to the point that we are creating any nonsense in the name of Sankirtan, but to play out the spaciousness and breadth and depth of Mahaprabhu's movement. Mahaprabhu's movement is very deep, but very broad. Breadth and depth, both. So if we are part of that movement, we have to honor the movement by properly representing both the depth and the breadth of Sankirtan. And it all begins by trying to define what we are talking about. What's this Sankirtan thing? With depth and breadth. Before saying, let's pick cartels, let's open the button, let's go to the streets, let's take over in the world. Stop all that and become acquainted with reality on a deeper level. On a deeper level. Anyhow. Sorry, further reflections. That's how Sankirtan happens, right? We cannot contain, and there's always something else to be done. And part of the Sankirtan, we have created a new version of Sankirtan now, which is called Zoom breakout rooms. That was not during Mahaprabhu's times because there was no Zoom, but it's a natural extension of Sankirtan, which is we will be inviting each one of you in small groups of three or something, in communion, churning together what we've shared so far for a few minutes. That's also Sankirtan. That's also Yuga Dharma. So Bhakti Rasa will open those rooms now for a few minutes. Then we will return. There are a few more raised hands, and we'll continue then with any other offerings you may be bringing today to the table. There you are. Welcome. Welcome back to each one of you. Hoping you had an insightful moments, a few minutes, but a lot can happen in a few minutes. We're gonna attain all perfection in a nanosecond, so a lot can happen in a few minutes. So let's continue to some of the questions. Now there have been a few raised hands, and so let's see if we can honor everything that is coming in terms of questions and inquiries. I'm continuing with the order of the digital raised hands, and the next one came from Samadarshini. But I'm not sure if she, oh yeah, there she is.
Yeah,
Welcome.
I'm here. Hare Krishna Maharaj. So my question is how to lose the grip of wanting to control outcomes. I catch myself like my mind is going into a fantasy, into an attachment, and it creates so much suffering, but it's so difficult to let go and to kind of lean into the uncertainty of life. It's kind of it's almost like freaking out internally, like, oh my God, I have to let go here. But my mind is, and then the mind fantasizing. It's like I'm aware of these things, but at the same time, I also experience difficulties and yeah, practicing it. If you could share anything around that.
Well, first of all, giving you an official welcome to the club of those who freak out internally. Welcome. Please, you all welcome her as well. You're all part of the club as well. Don't play it like you are not part of that club. So I think that's the first and probably most important part of the answer. To begin with, which is to normalize an abnormal condition as much as we can normalize it, of course, right? I'm not saying this, that's perfect. Samadarshini is the goal of life, stay there forever. You will say, no, Maharaj, I'm freaking out internally. I don't want to stay here forever. So I'm not saying stay there forever, but also I'm not saying next weekend you need to be out of there because if not, you have a very severe problem. No. So, normalizing, right? As simple as that sounds, I think we need to normalize what we have been so expert at stigmatizing for a long time. And I don't know the particulars of each one of your story in detail. I have enough with my own with the particulars of my own story to deal with. But many of us sometimes we may come with a heavy load of stigmatizing what should have been normalized. So may for many of us, our main focus will maybe to heal those endless chapters and decades of stigmatization, if that's how you pronounce the word, and normalizing. Again, not like cheat self-deception and I want to stay here forever, but self-compassion, let's put it that way. Accepting that this is part of the journey. Maharaj, I'm unstable. Yes, you are. You are supposed to be for where you are on the journey. You are not probably Raghunath Das Goswami, so chill out and relax for a moment. If you try to imitate Raghunath Das Goswami, I'm already saving you in place in the nearby mat house or something. It won't work. Well, I was reading yesterday in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Raghunath Das Goswami, right? Since we are talking about Raghunath Das Goswami. When he met Mahaprabhu, he wanted to leave everything behind and join Mahaprabhu. And here we have Raghunath Das Goswami, not me, Raghunath Das Goswami. He had He was not escaping from anything, doing spiritual bypassing. He was madly in love with Mahaprabhu and genuinely willing to join him and able to release so much. And Mahaprabhu, what did he say? Don't rush. No, don't behave like a madman. Go back to your house. Take responsibility over there. Eventually, everything will happen so you can join me. He's saying that to Raghunath Das Goswami. So my point with this is like normalizing certain life chapters that sometimes we may like to move faster. And I want to get out of this place. And I totally understand who wants to freak out internally, as you were describing. It's not comfortable. Sometimes it feels too intense. But I'll say that part of the coexisting with that thing is, in big part, trying to befriend my inner turmoil. Because your question, in other words, is how to control my mind. And of course, this comes over and over again in our tradition. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the sixth chapter, Arjuna is telling Krishna basically what you are saying. He's not saying I'm freaking out, but he's saying to control the mind is more difficult than to embrace the wind. It's basically impossible. And Krishna, he doesn't say, oh, Arjuna, you are exaggerating. You are playing the victim. Come on, guy. You are Arjuna. Do it. He says, yeah, it's quite complex. He's not saying it's impossible. Arjuna is not saying it's impossible. Arjuna is saying it feels impossible at times. And Krishna is kind of like, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it is. So there's acceptance. That's my point in all this. Acceptance as a preliminary step. Accept the difficult, the complexity of the situation, accept that it will take time, and accept all that with a smile, not with like self-pity or like, oh, well, okay, I have to accept it. There's no other chance. What to do? Like with that type of, how to say in English? Begrudgingly? With that type of, oh, okay, I accept. That's not acceptance. There's lots of resistance in that acceptance. So accept where you are. Again, I'm not saying stay there forever, but as Carl Rogers will say, famous psychologist, the paradox here is you can only change something if you first accept where you are. As, let's say I want to change where I am 100%. Okay, first you have to accept where you are. We cannot talk about changing anything. First, we have to talk about accepting everything. But all that I have to accept all that is so difficult and painful. Yeah. But it's even more difficult and painful trying to change all that without accepting it first. So first comes this honest assessment of where I am in this particular chapter of my journey. Self-acceptance, self-compassion. Bringing it into the picture, Krishna is accepting me unconditionally, loving me infinitely in the midst of my inner freaking out. Bring all those spices to the masala before trying to change anything. Because if not, we will try to change anything for the wrong reasons. Out of guilt, toxic shame, I do not belong, I have to earn, I have to impress, I have to. Endless list of wrong reasons to change. And spiritual life is all about changing. So we have to be very careful to embrace spiritual life and therefore embrace change for the wrong reasons. Because our whole spiritual project will be an obsession with change for the wrong reasons. I have nothing against change, but as long as change comes from the right reasons and for a healthy foundation of despite all the things that I want to change and I haven't changed yet, I'm being loved by Krishna. I'm being loved by so many other people. I'm being accepted. And I have to learn to accept myself. And all the things that I have to change actually do not belong to my inner identity. It's not me, interestingly enough. All that madness is not an ontological attribute of the soul, right? The soul is not ontologically crazy, thank God. It's just that I'm identifying with that. So I need to gradually disidentify with that and get more in touch with who I actually are. It's a gradual process. Meanwhile, I have to navigate things with compassion. And the mind, I may feel okay, the mind is almost impossible to control. I feel it's my worst enemy, blah, blah, blah. Fair enough. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 6:6, Bandhurat Matmanastasya Janatmai Batmanajitaha. Anatmanastu Shatrutve. Mind out of control, worst enemy. Mind under control, best friend. The challenge of the day, turn your worst enemy into your best friend. That's basically our daily sadhana. All the things that we feel are my worst enemy, and many times it's us. I mean, we think we are our worst enemy, or we treat ourselves as such. Turn all that into how you will treat your best friend. That's not easy. I'm never saying the word easy, right? But that's a daily showing up. That's sadhana. That's why Krishna, when Arjuna says mind is so difficult to control, and Krishna says yes, he accepts that. Then he says, but it's possible through practice, showing up daily. Proper company, detachment. And detachment, again, doesn't mean dysfunctional indifference. Detachment means zoom out enough so you can get a bigger picture and you can invoke things that you are not losing sight by having zoomed in so much into the wrong direction. So, by daily practice and detachment, by daily introspection and invoking bigger picture, and daily showing up. In healthy association that reminds me how loved I already am, gradually things start to shift. Gradually, I may still not be the most self-controlled person, self-realized guy on the block, but I'm learning to deal with the whole situation in a less freaky way, so to say. Because sometimes we freak out not so much by what's going on, but by how we see ourselves in relation to what's going on. Sometimes because we do not accept ourselves at all, we freak out by the most minimum imperfection. So sometimes it's not so much you will stop freaking out when you are perfect. You will stop freaking out when you learn to accept yourself more in your imperfection. And that's the beginning of real perfection, a perfection that includes imperfection, not excludes imperfection. And that's not easy. I mean, it's in one sense, it's easy and it should be the most natural thing. We are not the easy ones. Somehow we became so complex. Somehow we bought into the idea that I need to be complicated. Things need to be complicated in order to work. So a big part of our learning now is unlearning a lot. That's the hardest part of the learning process, both for the teacher and the student. It's a nightmare for both. Right? For the student, I have to unlearn, and for the teacher, oh my gosh, I make you unlearn the thing that come up over and over and over again for decades. I'm saying that with smile, right? So it's not bad, but that's part of the process. When that freaking out, whatever coming, freaking in and then freaking out is happening, we should stay with ourselves and say, why do I am feeling this? Why? Why I cannot accept this for what it is first and then change, but first acknowledge this is here, this voice, this feeling, this thought, this instability. What prevents me from letting that be? What's the message there? What's the teaching of this moment for me? Rather than get out of here. How do I get rid of this as soon as possible? What can I learn from this? What is the message behind it? Where this is coming from? So trying to sit with that, listen to that as fearlessly as we can. And when it becomes too fearful, that's what Sangha is for as well, right? We can offer each other to each other so we don't feel that lonely. We don't feel isolated in that experience. We don't feel it's only happening to me. I don't feel extremely ashamed of what I'm experiencing because I feel I'm the only one going through all that. So Sangha is very important because you can voice your life, your journey, and generally you can very quickly find I'm not the only one. And that offers assurance, that gives support, that puts your situation in a bigger context, not in the island that we feel it's me, it's me. And I'm not talking to you, Sama Darshini, specifically everything I'm saying. I'm talking just in general for each one of us. because again, your question started with how to. So I was like, okay, another how to question. But there's no magical formula to the how to questions, right? At the end, in one sense, all the how to questions could be replied with the word practice. But then the word practice needs to be unpacked and clarified. What do we mean by practice? So we, as I try to clarify what Sankirtan, so we don't understand practice as a mechanical, again, performance, and I have to do it in a certain way, and I have to be perfect, and at some point all this will have to disappear, rather than doing it in a more accepting way, sensitive way, compassionate way, in the context of Krishna's unconditional love, Mahaprabhu's unconditional love, Sri Radha's unconditional love. And normalizing instability, at least for some part of the journey, that cannot but happen. I mean, not only I should not be frustrated that it's happening, but in one sense, I should not be expecting anything else but that mostly. Not because that's bad, but that's the main features of that landscape, so to say, of that chapter of the journey. That's as I always say it, when you if one studies Madhurya Kadambini by Bhishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur, this detailed description of all the stages of bhakti, this stage called Anishchita Bhajana Kriya, instability in bhakti. And there are all the symptoms: Utsahamayi, Ghana Tarala, Bhuddha Vikalpa, Tarangarangini. No? You have difficulty in keeping your vows and promises. Initial enthusiasm, then the enthusiasm goes away, struggle comes, ups and downs. So many beautifully embarrassing things. And he describes each one of them in utmost detail, even with a sense of tragic humor, and giving examples that you don't know if to laugh or to cry, because you identify so much with each one of those. It's like, that's my unauthorized self-biography, one chapter after another. What's going on here? But he's given a lot of big time to that section to make the point of this is where most of us are, guys. Not Vishwanath Chakravarti, but for most, learn to normalize that. It may last for some time. Learn to accept. That's part of the journey, but that's part of the bhakti journey. You already embarked upon the path of bhakti. So all these ups and downs are happening in the context of bhakti. Yeah, the messiness is there in the context of bhakti. Don't decontextualize your messiness. Messiness is happening inside the holy perimeter of bhakti. So it's a holy messiness, it's a blessed messiness. And bhakti is always more powerful than all our messiness put together. Let's not put our messiness on top of bhakti. That's nonsense. No. So, in other words, the fact that he's describing all that in the context of bhakti, he's saying basically each one of these symptoms, as embarrassing as they may be, they are confirmations that you are on the path. Indirectly, they are proving that you are treading the sacred path of bhakti. So they feel embarrassing, but in that paradoxically, they are giving you hope by confirming that's all this is happening in the context of bhakti. Therefore, it's glorious. Because again, you cannot expect much more to happen by that time in your journey. You don't expect to hear the flute of Krishna and roll on the ground and fade for 3 days. This as much as can happen at this given time of your journey, and he's describing, and that's happening in the context of bhakti. It cannot get as better as this. Learn to appreciate that. That's basically the spirit of that section. It's not so much dismiss that and just insist on being in ecstasy tomorrow. You won't be there if you cannot appreciate what's coming to you today. So again, all these ups and downs and messiness, indirectly they are affirming, confirming we are on the sacred path. So we should find reasons to celebrate that. We should find a type of reassurance and hope in the midst of that messiness. And from that positive orientation, we'll be able to deal with whatever we need to deal for sure in the best possible way. And that will warranty our progress to the next chapter and the next chapter and so on and so forth. So it's all about developing our, again, proper sambandha, proper orientation. How do I relate to this chapter? How do I relate to this stage of my life? Bhaktivedanta is saying just like a child development. It's like all development, right? All our life, we are developing so many stages: child, teenage, adult, elder, whatever. Each one has their own things. Each one has their own embarrassments and their own beauty and whatever, their own everything. And you have to accept all of them. And even not saying better, worse, it's what it is. And how do I relate to this as better as I can? So I have a few thoughts that are coming now. Samadarshan, you let me know if you have any further thoughts, if it helps.
It definitely does help. And I'm kind of, I realize that for me, acceptance comes with a lot of grief and pain. And that's kind of why I'm avoiding it, or my mind is fantasizing, sugarcoating kind of pulls me away from the reality as it is. And now facing it, it's like, oof, it's difficult for me to swallow, but that's, yeah. But your words really helped.
Yeah, and thank you for adding that layer because it's a very important one. And again, for me, that's the beginning for you to be self-compassionate with yourself, right? Like, okay, why it's so difficult for me to release or to accept some things, and instead I try to fantasize. And again, it's not you. All of us do that in one time or another, one way or another. So trying to get again more self-understanding why I'm doing that. Well, because this entails contacting grief, contacting pain. Okay, that you are gaining further insight already in that moment. That's a new layer of insight right there that you need to. As complex as that is and as terrifying as it may be, it still is a further degree of clarity. One veil moved. Okay, there is grief and pain. I'm afraid of contacting that. But I'm sure that also a deeper voice knows, but I need to contact that. I need to enter into a conversation with that. I may not be able to do it tomorrow. It may not happen in one day. It may be a long process, I may need support, all that perfectly. But you're already seeing that there's a deeper voice probably confirming it. So, and you can be again, have more self-understanding and self-compassion of knowing, okay, that's why I'm, well, that's maybe one of the reasons why I'm feeling probably stuck or something in this situation. But at the same time, it's a valid reason not to stay there forever, but it makes sense that I may feel terrified about taking that next step. Again, that's how, in one sense, the Bhagavad Gita starts. Try to see yourself in Arjuna in chapter one, Vishada Yoga, the yoga of despair. And Arjuna wants to run away from the battlefield and wants to fantasize. What if I become a beggar and I don't need to be in this battle and I don't need to confront the things that are terrifying because they will cause break my heart in many ways? And Krishna is, as a good friend, he's listening, holding space, and he's trying to tell his friend, do not spiritually bypass, and there's nothing, don't run away. I can understand you want to run away. I can understand. And we may have run away many times, and then we are back again in the same situation because that's how it works, right? We cannot totally escape this. So there's a point where we have to sit with our emotions, not sit on top of our emotions. Sit with them in conversation, fear, pain, loss, betrayal, grief, whatever may be the case. And trying to trust the unfolding of that. Try trusting that all those things will, as much as we may feel they are breaking our heart, they are breaking our heart open. So it's a type of blossoming. They are crafting the space of our inner being to be for it to be more spacious. And again, it's a gradual process, right? I don't want to sound here cheaply saying, come on, guys, don't be afraid, do it. It takes time, it may take lifetimes, depending the case. As long as we don't, deceive ourselves in, no, that's not necessary. No, that's necessary in one way or another for all of us. So, yeah, I think Jesse is maybe stay with that new layer of insight that is coming, right? Like, okay, why I'm a little bit like reticent, and okay, there's grief. Okay. Yeah. And maybe again, staying with that and accepting yourself, in acknowledging all that, accepting those things as part of your life and trusting that all of that can make us more human also. And we need all to be more human. Most of us humans are not very human, right? So all many of these things come to humanize our spirituality. I'm reading among a few books. One of those is a beautiful book. Soon will come. I already read it before. It's called At Play with Krishna, which actually is a book that depicts different dramatic plays done in Vrindavan with different depictions of Krishna's Leelas. Last night I was reading the Leela where Krishna's taken out of Vrindavan and never to return in one level, in one sense. And the author is beautifully describing, and he's there in the play, surrounded by all these Brajavasis. And before even Krishna is taken out of Vrindavan, they already know the story. And they're anticipating all that is about to come. They are already crying, knowing what's going to happen. And when it's happening, this author is his scholar, Christian scholar, but he's surrounded with this ocean of grief. It's another type of grief, but my point with this is still grief. It's still pain. It's still a form of heartbreak. So our tradition is not against contacting these emotions. And we may not be able to still have a heartbreaking separation of Krishna from Krishna. Okay, what's the corresponding heartbreak I'm supposed to go through in my own life journey? And that will, no, there is a Christian author friend of mine, Adam Buco. He wrote a book called Follow Your Heartbreak. Because there is this famous line from Joseph Campbell, Follow Your Bliss, which we are not against that either. But he also wrote a book called Follow Your Heartbreak. Because sometimes it's not everything is bliss. And still heartbreak is a way of, it's a type, it's its own breadcrumbs. It's giving its own hints. It's calling us grief, pain, how to embrace that. Again, that's a whole other topic talking about grief and grief, but that's a very necessary layer that we need all to integrate. So thank you. Thank you for that. And let's go one more time to breakout rooms. I think this is an important topic that deserves more attention, at least more than a few more minutes, but at least a few minutes all together sharing and offering space and sharing and hearts and support to each other, how to navigate this particular chapter that probably most of us are in one way or another. So see you in a few minutes back. Welcome you all back. And thanks for, the willingness and courage to meet with each other and share vulnerably, showing up. Very healing, very important work. So there are a few more questions. I don't think I will get to encompass all of them. I will speak with Pranada and ask her to speak to her privately. Maybe we can speak about that one with her or anyhow. I want to give priority to those who are live connected. That's my point. And there are two more raised digital hands, one from Divyangana and one from Kanupriya, one of the two. And since we don't have that much time to address both, I will reply, try to say something, but maybe not in detail. And also, I request, yeah, whatever sharing you have to do it in a time that it allows for the other one to be shared as well. So, next one in the order is Divyangana from France. I'm not seeing her. Okay, I'm not seeing her. So probably she had to leave or she disconnected. So that leaves us with Kanupriya. Now the question is which Kanupriya? From Germany.
The German
German. No, I don't want to make you over-identify with the country you were born.
one.
It's just like, you know. Okay. Welcome,
Okay.
Kanupriya.
I have a follow-up question to the first one of Trivikram Prabhu, about Sankirtan, so-called preaching and so on. So nowadays there are so many groups doing kirtan, especially in big cities like Berlin, for example. We have many groups in yoga studios, but also in other places, and some of them are very successful. They have hundreds of participants coming to the kirtans, most of them, they chant many different kinds of kirtan, also Maha Mantra and so on. And so there's some discussions in our community and others. So shall we cooperate together with other kirtan groups to also maybe attract more people, and also to learn or to open up to others, because also to overcome this division, we are devotees and these are yoga people or whatever. So you never know what is inside the heart. So we did some efforts to come together, to do kirtan together and so. But then on the other side, we sometimes experience, oh, something is missing. Okay, we sing Maha Mantra and it's beautiful and so on, but if there's not this bhakti inside, then something is missing. So we are not clear about it. What is best? And of course, I don't want an answer. Okay, do it like this and do it like this, or don't do
Thank you. Thank you.
it like this. Yeah, but somehow, I mean, also, of course, even in Hare Krishna temples, there's no guarantee that when there is kirtan, there's 100% bhakti inside. Sometimes there's also a lot of ego and so on, and something is missing, and then you feel empty when you go out. So it's not black and white, of course, but yeah, it's a challenge to cooperate with other groups. And some devotees say, okay, no, better stay in our small group, but have real bhakti kirtans, then to open up. Yeah, a lot of discussions are going on. So maybe you can contribute something to these discussions.
Again, I cannot. It's in one sense, it's a very local situation, what you are presenting. Not the particular dynamics with the community there, and so it's local. So I'm not part of that community. I'm not there in the local dynamics. I don't know the people involved. So there are so many things that I'm missing, no, in terms of the uniqueness of the situation that need things that need to be known and in order to be addressed. So I'm missing all that. So I cannot speak for the particular situation again. And I say always that I can only give a more generic answer, trusting the discernment of the locals to apply that accordingly to their own time, place, and circumstance. But of course, again, we already in part, at least partly, was replied with, I hope, with what I shared to Trivikram Prabhu in terms of first sit and say, what's this kirtan all about? What's this about? How we are, at least from our side as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, how we are invited to participate in Sankirtan according to our tradition. Because again, sometimes we end up seeing Sankirtan more as a resource to reach out to people. And again, I'm not entirely against that, but from where that's coming, right? And then, because if not, we start to measure all the things in my opinion, external way. So that kirtan is very successful. It attracts lots of people who say that's a measure of success, right? Gaur Kishore Das Babaji was not very successful, my friends, because he only had one disciple. He didn't attract thousands. So he was not successful, sorry, right? Who will say that? Sanatan Goswami, less successful. He initiated zero disciples. Can you imagine? Totally unsuccessful. And surely we'll say, no, that's not success. The measure of success is very different. So why we are then superimposing ideas of success more like a company? Like we have this number of people attracted, that means we are more successful. It's not quantity. It's not quantity, it's quality. Quality attracts quantity. That's my stance, at least. Though I know that I've heard that some other people have said the exact opposite, which I respectfully disagree with. Some people I've heard said, some, I don't know, regarding the number of rounds, right? And some people struggling with finishing a certain number per day. And some other people say, well, you keep the number and the quality will come by you keeping the number. And it's like, that's not my mathematics. No. The more quality, the quantity will follow irresistibly. It's not that by forcing yourself to keep a daily quota, someday magically you are filled with quality and relish and taste. So again, success, we use the word success, but we may end up using the word success as an entrepreneur in this world. We'll use the word success, right? Impacting a number of people and getting numbers in. And but we are not after numbers, we are after quality. If numbers come, welcome, but not, I will say from my place, not at the cost of quality. Quantity, sorry, I don't want quality at the cost of quantity. If we have to sacrifice one of the two, I hope we have very clear which one to throw into the fire. So regarding the specifics of the question, again, you mentioned at one point, well, maybe we can cooperate with some other people that may help us to reach out to more people. So still, at least from that place, the consideration is more like how we get to reach out more people. And I'm talking in general, again, I don't know the situation. But I will say the ideal consideration for Sankirtan is not what's the best case scenario to reach out more people? But first of all, from where are we doing what we're doing? Why do we want to reach more people? Just that basic question. Stay with that question. Why do I want to reach more people? I mean, then the answer may be because we are supposed to, because I was told to, because that's what we are about. And there are lots of assumptions in many of those cases that have not been clear played out, in my opinion. And I know that lots of people would disagree with me, and I'm totally fine with that. It's fine. There's place for all of us in Mahaprabhu's movement. But yeah, of course, on the other side, you mentioned this idea, okay, we can collaborate with other people so we can be open, not so much in our own box. That I can appreciate, of course. Cross-pollination and learning from each other. How that works in practice, that's another thing. And again, why you are feeling it's working or not, there are many local details that I do not know about. But I really trust into cross-pollination. It may be in the form of kirtan, or it may be in the form of hanging out together in one way and learning from each other, as I personally love to do when I meet with different brothers and sisters from brotherly and sisterly traditions, for me it's beautiful. Probably again, I may not be able to do all the things they do in their sadhanas. They won't be able to do the things they might do because we have chosen our paths. But that doesn't mean we cannot share in so many beautiful ways. So I think there is a place of not being too insular and allowing influences from outside your own tribe to not only, again, not to look nice on society, right? Not to people, for people say, oh, they are not a cult. You see, they engage in interfaith dialogue. Sometimes people engage in interfaith dialogue just to show face, not out of the willingness to be transformed by the dialogue itself. So if I'm not showing up to a dialogue willing to be transformed by the other person, that's not dialogue. Dialogue has never begun. I'm already coming with my own narrative and I'm not open to be changed by yours. So how can I call that dialogue? So if there is dialogue or collaboration or contribution, there has to be a willingness to be affected by the other person. I may choose that to be the case, or I may choose to, no, I don't want to be to receive that particular influence. That's fine. But one has to choose. And I think it's healthy to choose in one way or another so we can remain open to influence from other people. We may not be able to do kirtan together, but we may can meet and talk and learn from each other or whatever. Also, we may find, yeah, we have this particular flavor of bhakti. That's my thing. That's my taste. And it doesn't mean they do not have their own flavor of bhakti. It doesn't mean that they don't have bhakti. It may be just a different taste of bhakti that is not my favorite one. And still, we could do something together. It doesn't mean we have to be all day together, but we can do something together, appreciate each other, share, be nourished by that, and then each other returns to their own favorite meal, so to say, right? So, to give you an example, I don't know. I could be very fascinated and enriched talking with for hours and hours with, I don't know, Krishna Chandra Prabhu from Switzerland about the depths of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And I'm just mentioning him randomly, so many others. And I know we both have done that. So I know that, I don't know, I know that's not a possible, it's something that could happen, something that has happened and will continue to happen. And I will be just very happy. And that's my thing. But also, I can talk to other people with whom I cannot talk about those things. To that level, in that language, with that specificity, with certain nuance, because they are not familiar with that. But it doesn't mean that I cannot share with them and be enriched with them in a certain way, in a different way, that can be complementary to my sharing with Krishna Chandra. It's not one against the other. So, how to find that way of not being insular, not ending up being cultish, basically, and being our own point of reference and opening to other people, even to other Gaudiya groups, as I said the other day. Sometimes it's not even about sister tradition. Sometimes we, ironically, we appreciate sister traditions, Christianity, whatever, Sufism, but we don't know how to talk with other Gaudiya Vaishnava branches of the same tree. So that's where you need to start first. As I said the other day, I think, right? Even I meet with friends from Christian, Jewish, Sufi tradition, and they all acknowledge, oh, your school is totally bona fide and you will attain all perfection. But then I meet other Gaudiya Vaishnava from other lineages and they don't accept that. So we have a lot of homework to do at home, a lot of laundry still. So that will be another way of them. And again, it all boils down to motivation. Why? Why I'm going to this person, why I'm not going to this person, what in me resists to open to this particular situation, and so on and so forth. So, and all that for me will be another way more substantial measure of success than just having the room filled with people, packed room. That was success. I mean, I'm not saying that's bad again. I had nothing against numbers, but numbers for the sake of numbers. And at the cost of going deeper into diversity and openness and allowing ourselves to be transformed by what's different to our own narrative. That can be dangerous because we end up becoming obsessed and fascinated just with numbers, just with outreach, just with people, and that becomes the only measure of success. And everything else is collapsing, everything else is superficial or flat, but we have so much numbers going on. I'm not speaking about any particular case here while saying that, but it can happen. So the numbers, the quantity, the outreach becomes kind of the only yardstick, the only thermometer to convince ourselves, not even to convince others, that we are successful, we are in the wrong way, in the right path, sorry, while everything else is collapsing in more and more obvious ways. So yeah, many times we just need to redefine what we mean by success. And we will need to do that many times during our practice. We thought success meant something on day one, then a few years after, success meant something else as a bhakta, then success meant something else. So we need to continue the alchemy, refining our definitions of success and all these fancy words till they become more and more deep, more and more personal, more and more internal, more and more substantial. Again, Mahaprabhu, going back to Mahaprabhu and Sankirtan, the whole thing began in a private room, very intimate, very personal, very profound, very deep. Then it exploded irresistibly. But then, interestingly, Mahaprabhu, at one point, the whole thing became so deep for him personally that he went back to a room and locked himself in for 12 years. That's also an interesting dynamics that we need to pay attention to. How Sankirtan is taking us out, then it's taking us in a certain, and I'm not saying everyone should do it in the exact same way as Mahaprabhu did, but there is an important message there about keep your inner life, keep your inner flame as a priority. Not a selfish thing, because your inner flame is not only yours. You are not an isolated being. And whatever is shared from that, whatever touches other from that, whatever numbers and success come from that, that's blessed. That's bona fide. But whatever effort is done for the sake of numbers of success independent from a concern to cultivate inner life, that's when it becomes a problem because we start to replace one thing for the other. And that becomes an anartha, becomes a false value. I'm ascribing value to something. The value of something, I am ascribing it to something else. And that's not possible. So that's as much as I can speak generally. Of course, the specifics of the local situation, you need to figure that out, guys. All prayers and blessings to German Yatra. And again, I have nothing against sharing the blessedness of the holy name with others and sharing satsang and creating spaces for sharing. But again, hopefully it comes from a place of fullness and celebration and not emptiness and pressure and guilt and I have to and converting and imposing and external ideas of success, but deep compassion and joy and overflowing and what we have been talking about. Yeah, and hopefully with some diversity in between. Again, we may need our group to do our own intimate, personal, private thing. It makes sense. Our like-minded spirits, our inner tribe, Antaranga, Sangha, like Mahaprabhu had he had four associates with whom he discussed certain things. Only with four. He had many associates. But only with four, he went into certain detail with some things. It's not that he was discriminating the others. He just made the point, there are certain things that you can only relish with a bunch of people. Because you need to know each other enough, and it takes time to know each other. And you cannot know each other in depth with 3,000 people. You don't have that time. So you have that inner tribe, you will relish something unique with them. It's not that the other people is wrong. Then you go to other people and other circles, different expansion of circles, and you can share with all of them as much as the situation allows, and that's beautiful. That doesn't replace the relishment of the inner circle, but the inner circle doesn't become so insular that you cannot talk to anyone else because no, everything else tastes different from what I taste in my inner circle. Of course it does. Huh? I'm meeting all these different mothers, but none of them feels like my mom. Of course it doesn't, because my mom is my mom. And it doesn't mean that because of that, she's better than any of you mothers present here. It's what it is, right? So, but that doesn't prevent that my mom is my mom. So I won't talk to anyone else who have a kid because my mom is so special. So finding a balance where we can expose ourselves to diversity, be nourished and transformed with it without the need of abandoning our special taste and inclination and probably intimate tribe family with whom we share something very unique. It all can find its place. The Achintya Veda Veda Tattva equation, unity and diversity all put together. Okay, so I don't know if that helps. You tell me.
Yes, of course. There were so many principles. I mean, I think it's a everybody has to reflect for himself or herself. Okay,
Please don't make
what
me
is
reflect for
my
each one of you. I'll go crazy.
no, what is my motivation in it? And then we can come and discuss and
Yeah.
this was very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I can as much share a few thoughts and trust your integrity, and you will find what's triggering you and you will do your work. I mean, I cannot do any of that myself. I will go crazy if I try to play that role, and it's not possible. So, yeah, but it's funny because it's kind of a riddle because I know that the question, your question, and almost every question that is presented is many times very, almost always very personal. Personal with a local background specificity that I do not know. So it's kind of a riddle, the question. It's like, okay, what's going on? And I don't know what's going on. And I'm not like trying to speculate, okay, this may be happening and there may be a person doing this. I cannot do all that. It will be like full-fledged gambling. But at the same time, yeah, I have to say something. So that puts one in a very interesting place. So speaking about putting ourselves in a very interesting place, let's put our sharing to rest by going one final time to our breakout rooms, since Dibyangana was not coming back for the question, and we'll address any remaining questions during the next meeting. But a few more minutes in our breakout, breakthrough, break open, breakdown rooms, whatever needs to be broken in any direction. And see you back in a few minutes too for our official goodbye. Okay. Welcome back one more time. Thanks for your time and willingness to spend with us in Satsang, Sankirtan, Istogoshti today. Looking forward to meeting you next Saturday or whenever it's able to you, or next Monday for our study of Srimad Bhagavatam, those of you who are available. Whatever may be the case, may you have a blessed conclusion of the day and start of the next one. Keep in touch. Srimad Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Paramananda Hari Hari Bol.